traditions related to the indigenous people of Colombia. The carnival is aimed at highlighting the diversity of ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Its name symbolizes unity and equality. The festival continues until January the 10th. A zoo in the Netherlands is celebrating the birth of a newborn manatee, a rare event among the endangered species, especially within the confines of captivity. The newcomer was born in a Royal Burger Zoo in the Dutch city of Arnhem. Zookeepers say the birth went smoothly, adding that this is the mother's second calf. The newborn is still too young for keepers to be able to determine its gender, but handlers hope it will be a female. That's because there are only 15 females in European zoos. Manatees are closely related to elephants and are sometimes called sea cows because of their herbivorous diet. These gentle giants are listed as vulnerable to extinction, mainly because of loss of habitat and collisions with boats.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to a new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading Republicans in Five States Forged Electoral College Documents, MSNBC host says. Stay tuned for more. Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. Trump loyalists forged documents in at least five states where Joe Biden had defeated Trump and submitted them for certification, according to Maddow. The forgeries do not look like the uniquely printed paperwork that the state submits, Maddow noted, but they used very specific language purporting that those who signed it were the duly elected and qualified electors for President and Vice President of the United States of America, even though they were not. It's not like they created these documents to like hold close to their chest and fantasize that this had been the real outcome, Maddow said. It's not like they created these documents just to keep for themselves as keepsakes. They sent them into the government as if they were real documents. Maddow also said that the effort to flip the election in Trump's favor appeared to be coordinated. The fake documents all match exactly, Maddow observed. Same formatting, same font, same spacing, almost the exact same wording, all of them. Later in the program, the MSNBC host connected these documents to a draft letter written by a Department of Justice official loyal to Trump named Jeffrey Clark, which explicitly describes these forged slates of electors from multiple states as part of a plan to keep the former president in office. It was unusual, Maddow said, that Clark was aware that these states had made these types of moves before he suggested the idea to Trump and his allies. Maddow asked, how did Clark know that 2 weeks earlier, Republicans in at least 5 states had in fact created these forged electoral documents? Did the Trump Justice Department know about it because they helped Republicans in those states do it? We don't know, but somebody helped them do it, because they all filed the exact same document. Other documents unearthed in the past year have detailed similar strategies designed by Trump allies to overturn the election. In one such document, Trump's former lawyer, John Eastman, devised a 6-point plan that relied upon multiple slates of electors being used to create confusion in the Electoral College certification process. Former Vice President Mike Pence could then use that confusion to force a vote in the House of Representatives, where Trump would then win the presidency, Eastman said. Weeks after the election was called for Biden, Trump aide Stephen Miller also said in December that the campaign's next step to challenging the election's outcome was to submit false certificates of ascertainment stating that Trump won in states where he didn't. An alternate slate of electors in contested states is going to vote, and we are going to send those results up to Congress, Miller said at the time, adding, this will ensure that all of our legal remedies remain open. That means if we win these cases in the courts, that we can direct the alternate slate of electors be certified.
The United States assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis marked one of the most significant acts of terrorism by a state actor in recent history. Today we take a look at the fallout from this escalation and how it has shaped relations and tensions between the United States and Iran. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed on January 3, 2020, in an American drone strike near the international airport at Baghdad. He was assassinated alongside Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Sha'bi. Both men played an extremely vital role in the region, the importance of which cannot really be overstated. General Soleimani, or as he's also known, Haj Qasem, was a general in Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and the commander of the Quds Force, Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic, signifying the goal to liberate the Middle East all the way to Jerusalem from the illegal occupation by Zionist and Western forces. The Quds force helped to establish Iran as a major force in the region and to defend Iran and its allies in several theaters of combat, fighting against Daesh, the United States, and the Zionist occupation. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was also assassinated in the same drone strike, was deputy commander of the PMU, or Hashid al-Sha'bi, which was formed in 2014, and is comprised of Shia, Sunni, Christians, and Druze militias, all fighting under one banner. Both these men were key players in the axis of resistance and a driving force all across the Middle East. Both the Quds force and the Hashid al-Sha'bi were hailed across the Middle East by all ethnicities in Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, for helping to coordinate resistance efforts and defend their lands from imperialism. Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played a key role helping to crush Daesh. The irony here is that not only did the United States and its allies give rise to the creation of Daesh, they then claimed to have defeated the problem that they created and killed Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi, who had done the real work. In reality, Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi have done more to fight terrorism, which the United States created, than anyone else. But because they also challenged U.S. hegemony, this is their real crime in the eyes of the Americans, and that's why they were killed. So this is why the United States always labels people who subvert their imperialist conquests as so-called terrorists, when actually they are the ones openly perpetrating terror. The United States attempted to justify this assassination by claiming it had intelligence that Haj Qasim was about to endanger American lives. Well, where is this intelligence? Because we've never seen it. Is it the same kind of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If so, I would hardly put much faith in what U.S. intelligence has to say. They conveniently make up things as they go along in order to suit their foreign policy agenda and have no shame in doing so.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
Moreover, this idea that the United States can preemptively attack countries and murder people is the same doctrine and fabricated defense that they used to justify the war in Iraq, to justify drone strikes, kidnappings, torture, rendition, and even murdering their own citizens in drone strikes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. President Donald Trump both claimed that Qasem Soleimani was a terrorist, with Donald Trump writing on his Twitter that he was hated in the region. Not only is this statement by the U.S. completely baseless and false, it's extremely insulting, actually. You know, after they were martyred, millions of people came out to attend their funerals. Both General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played an extremely important role in helping to crush Daesh in Syria and Iraq. So as a Syrian Christian myself, I'm personally grateful to them for this. They helped to liberate our lands from terrorism and saved countless lives from all backgrounds, including minorities and others that would have been killed at the hands of Daesh. Terrorists that the United States and its allies helped to create in the first place. So this is why after Haj Qasim was martyred, we saw several processions and masses even being held in his honor, recognizing his work. Joining me from Tehran is Dr. Sam Torabi, Director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thanks for joining me, Sam. How are you?
My pleasure.
We saw a really touching interview recently from Haj Qasim's daughter, Zainab Soleimani, where she spoke of how her father, he wasn't just fighting for Iran, but you know, for all people, for a greater good. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been the story of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution for 40 years, you know. I mean, the movement that happened with, you know, the Iranian nation and Imam Khomeini as its leader, you know, more than 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, was a global movement. It was a movement about, you know, truth versus, those forces in this world who want to oppress people. And the movement in Iran, the Islamic Revolution, the revolutionary movement in Iran, decided to not go that path. And of course, this is based on Islam, the real Islam, the Islam of the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Islam of the school of Ahlul Bayt, which neither, you know, accepts being oppressed nor accepts that one becomes an oppressor. So this is the school that Haj Qasim was living. He was an embodiment of it. He was a manifestation of it. And so when the Islamic Republic, when the state in Iran decided that they're going to, you know, make those strategic decisions that they did, which ended up that those forces then went into Syria, that was part of a larger thing. And the larger thing was what I was, you know, referring to right now, which is that it's not just about, you know, preventing Daesh from taking over Syria or any force that's going to cause havoc in the region, or, you know, some sort of a cynical power play between Iran and its enemies. It was a larger issue. It was, as we say in Farsi and Arabic, haq and batil. You know, that was what the war was about. Those who lived it, who saw it, I'm sure, you know, you can tell us more about this. That war in Syria really showed us the true faces of everybody. It was no longer about the labels, you know, Sunni, Shia, Christian, Muslim, you know, leftist, rightist, you know, everybody had to choose the right, had to choose, you know, haq or batil. And it became very clear very soon who's on the side of haq and who's on the side of batil.
So with the one-year anniversary upon us, the United States is claiming that, you know, Iran is firing rockets at the Green Zone at the embassy in Baghdad and saying that they're ready to retaliate against Iran. You know, it seems as though they're preemptively blaming Iran for something that they're going to do.
Well, I mean, all of them, Trump, Biden, you know, Democrats, Republicans, they're delusional. They think that, you know, that the Iraqi people don't have their own will. They think that the Syrian people don't have their own will. They think that, you know, the Lebanese people don't have their own will. They see everything through the lens of Iran. You know, it's a mental problem. I don't know how we can solve it. You know, they can't accept the reality that Iraqis would actually not like to be occupied and would actually resist. They can't fathom that. It doesn't fit into their, I don't know what we can call it. You know, the same goes for the Syrian people. The fact that, you know, the Syrian people would resist and not want, you know, crazy fanatic Takfiri Wahhabi, allow them to take over the country, and they would actually rise up and they would defend their own country, you know, with all the problems that might have existed in the system of governance that existed prior to the civil war. Nobody denies that. Nobody says that it was heaven. Nobody says that there weren't issues. But the issue is, you know, what's haq and what's batil? Obviously, you know, people are not going to sit there and just watch their country be ruined. Same goes for the Lebanese people and their resistance to the Zionist occupation of their lands and the continued threat that they face from the Zionists. So these are the problems that we have with the West, with the British, with the French, and now with the Americans as the inheritors of the imperial powers, as the inheritor of the British Empire, and also to a certain extent the French, for those countries that were under French influence. So they just can't, you know, believe that people would have their own agency and decide that they don't want to be occupied and that they might want to resist occupation. And let's not forget, you know, we talk about the American embassy, but it's actually, you know, it's the size of the Vatican. I mean, it's a huge, you know, it's basically the Americans are occupying a major part of Baghdad, which is the capital of a sovereign state. And in many ways, they want to effectively turn it into American soil, which is technically what happens when you have an embassy. It's technically the soil of the country in terms of the laws or in terms of the ability of the country in which that embassy is located to enter into that area. So, you know, it's not a building. It's not a bunch of towers or a bunch of buildings or whatever. It's an entire section of Baghdad, which, you know, is being ripped away from Iraqi sovereignty. And so this is a problem. This is not something that can last in the long run. This is something that, you know, imperial powers do. This is what countries do that want to come and stay for, you know, centuries, which, you know, is again another delusion among the Americans.
Right. So I mean, America thinks that, oh, Iran fired a few rockets in response and that's it, but they don't even really have someone of the same value or caliber as Haj Qasem on their side.
Well, what we have with Qasem, what we had with Abu Mahdi, These were exceptional human beings. These were people who worked on themselves. These were people who struggled and who reached a high level of consciousness, who reached a high level of purity in their personal behavior and in their lives. You know, let's not even go there with some of the things that we see. Many cases where, and this is all out in the open, where there is reports of massive corruption, personal and structural, within U.S. military. We have scandals erupting around the world where they are being bribed with, you know, things that I can't even mention on TV right now. And so, you know, these are like admirals and captains and generals and colonels. And these are supposed to be the so-called, you know, whatever army of the United States, the military forces of the United States. These are supposed to be the leaders of, so, you know, whatever mythology they want to create from it. And, you know, for us, we have to even not even put these two on a level where we can compare them. These are I'm talking about Haj Qasim, I'm talking about and of course, you know, the thousands of others who, like them, of their generation, after them. You know, when you enter into that world, it's a world where you have to really purify yourself. It's not something that is going to just go away. It's not something that is going to go away with sanctions. I mean, you know, just think about any other country or society in history having to endure these sanctions would have collapsed, you know, and yet we didn't, and we haven't, and thriving. Yes. Most Iranians don't have to worry about the basic necessities of life. Not only that, but we also have been able to really advance in ways that, you know, we were told the only way you can do that is if you connect yourself to some great power and become their obedient servant, and, you know, they will give you the technology.
Sam, thanks so much for your time and your valuable insight. Really appreciate having you on. Thank you so much. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So after Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi were martyred, how do you see the future of the axis of resistance?
Well, you know, this is another thing that's a Western problem, which is that their system of commanding and their system of leading is you have some heroic figure, you know, leading a bunch of sheep. And so if you get rid of that heroic leader, the sheep don't know what to do. But that's not the way it works. Here, the way it works is the whole movement that Imam Khomeini led is you have human beings being developed. So it's not that Haj Qasim was this person who is irreplaceable. Yes, he is irreplaceable to a certain extent in terms of a historic figure, but you know, it's not like when with him leaving or with Abu Mahdi not being here that things are going to change in any way, shape, or form. We have a system that's trying to actually develop human beings who are multifaceted, who not only look at things in terms of career and in terms of advancing their own personal ambitions, but in terms of building themselves and purifying themselves and self-edification. And so this is the kind of people that we have, you know, conducting the affairs, especially those who are involved in the military, whether it's the guards or whether it's the army or whether it's Basij. Or any other branch that's working. So it's not going to make any difference because the strategic goal of the Islamic Republic is to expel the Americans from West Asia. It's the stated goal, as stated by the Supreme National Security Council, as stated by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. This is the goal, and it doesn't matter if it's Haj Qasim who is commanding certain forces or whether it's others who are commanding it, or it doesn't matter even if it's Ayatollah Khamenei who is the leader or not. These things are not going to change with the coming and going of people. as you may have seen in the way that these Americans talk, they always talk about, well, when Ayatollah Khamenei is gone, we will do this, we will do that. Well, you know, this is exactly the same thing they said when Imam Khomeini was alive. They said, well, when Imam Khomeini goes, we'll do this, we'll do that. So it's this false projection of their own way of doing things, which is you have some heroic figure leading a bunch of people who have no ability to think for themselves. This is not the way it works here. And so with him or without him, the path continues. The strategic goal, as I mentioned, is the expulsion of America from West Asia. It's going to happen. And, of course, in terms of Israel, it's the establishment of a Palestinian state, of a Palestinian republic, where Christians, Muslims, Jews live as equal citizens of that Palestinian state. It's not about throwing the Jews into the sea, which is the propaganda that the Zionists always use. When we talk about ending Israel is not about killing Jews, it's not about getting rid of Jews, it's about ending a Zionist apartheid state. Exactly the way you had a apartheid state ending in South Africa, and it's evolving into a different thing. And so these goals are clear. We are not worried about losing the support of this president or that president. And so, basing whatever we do on whoever is going to call us from some second-tier official from the U.S., ordering us what to do or what not to do. Accept Israel and we'll give you this much money or whatever it was, even during the time of the Shah, this was the case. It's not about being closed off to the world. It's about, it's the system that we have in this region. The British called it and still call it Arab Fasad, which is the strategic, economic, and the security matters are determined by the West, and the leadership is Arab Fasad. This is in their own documents, and so these are the things that we're dealing with. Countries like Iran, countries like Syria, don't fit into that scheme of domination, and so that's why they're threatened, and in the case of Syria, pulled into this tragic war that went on for so many years.
The killing of General Soleimani marked one of the biggest escalations between the United States and Iran in recent history, which is actually saying something given how many provocations the U.S. has committed vis-a-vis Iran just in the last 2 years alone. Many speculated that his slaying would ignite an all-out conflict. But one can argue that given the magnitude of this transgression, that Iran has actually shown unbelievable restraint. Just ask yourself for 1 second, if Iran had assassinated an American general, wouldn't America have declared war in response? Once again, we see this imperialist double standard where it's okay for the U.S. to violate international laws and commit terrorism while pointing the finger at others. Iran has maintained that its real response in order to properly avenge General Soleimani has not come yet, and that they are saving this for a later date. Now, 2 days after the assassination, back in January, the Iraqi parliament unanimously passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all American troops from their soil. After all, this was not just an act of aggression towards Iran, but also a violation of Iraq's sovereignty as it took place on their soil. The United States has been illegally occupying Iraq ever since its invasion in 2003 over weapons of mass destruction that were never found. And of course, the U.S. ignored this new measure by Iraqi lawmakers and has still not left Iraq. A few days later, after the assassination, Iran fired a barrage of rockets at the Ayn al-Assad air base in Iraq, which belongs to the illegal U.S. occupation forces. No one was killed in this attack, but the U.S. hilariously claimed that 110 of its personnel had received, quote, traumatic brain injuries from this attack. Again, one cannot really consider this a true response to the assassination of General Soleimani, as the U.S. military does not even have anyone who is really comparable or of the same value to Haj Qasem, no less a bunch of regular service members, as they call them. Nonetheless, in another significant move, Iran said it would no longer abide by the limitations of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or Iran Nuclear Deal, as it's also called. Iran said it would continue to cooperate with international monitors, but would abandon the constraints on the number of centrifuges it's allowed to have. This marked the fifth step in Iran reducing its commitment to the deal, after Trump unilaterally pulled out of it in May 2018, and then also slapped Iran with crippling sanctions, and also proceeded to order this assassination, which is frankly tantamount to a declaration of war. In the days following the killing, the U.S. Congress introduced the Iran War Powers Resolution in order to try and limit Trump's ability to use military force against Iran. It passed both the Democrat-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, only to be vetoed by Trump himself. In order to justify this act of terrorism, the Trump regime pointed not only to the U.S. Constitution, but also to the 2002 authorization of use of military force against Iraq. These arguments are farcical either way. Just because the U.S. Congress votes to attack another country, that doesn't mean that it is okay or legally acceptable. Even if both houses of Congress wanted to limit Trump's powers in this regard, it's still not up to the United States to unilaterally decide that it can attack other nations. U.S. law does not supersede the U.N. Charter nor international conventions. This is absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's actually very typical of American exceptionalism. Agnes Callamard, who's the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, condemned the assassination of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi. She said the attack was an unlawful killing and concluded that the United States had violated the United Nations Charter. Speaking about a memo that the Trump regime gave to the U.S. Congress, she said information that Trump administration officials provided was remarkably vague and inconsequential as far as a possible imminent threat is concerned. Even at the most basic level, the U.S. did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary.
The targeted killing of the Iranian general Qassem Soleimani, concluding that his was a violation of the UN Charter governing the use of force and an arbitrary killing. On January 3rd, 2020, the world moved into a very different space. On that day, the United States used unarmed drones to target and kill Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, as well as a number of his companions, including largely Iraqi representatives. That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the first known incident in which a state invokes self-defense as justification for an attack against a government official outside a declared armed conflict.
Recently, in the lead-up to the anniversary of the assassination, Washington has said it is moving personnel out of positions inside Iraq for fear of, quote, retaliation from Iran. The head of U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, said the U.S. is prepared to react if Iran tries to avenge Soleimani's death. Once again, this is a hypocritical, ridiculous point because the United States committed the original act of aggression, but it pretends that it is somehow the victim. Donald Trump also claimed on his Twitter that Iranian-made rockets had been fired at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, which shows that the U.S. is acting nervously and preemptively trying to blame any aggression that it might take on made-up stories. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, his rebuttal included a stark reminder of how the United States lied about the Iraq war, starting wars based on fabrications and doesn't really care about its own citizens. And indeed, if the United States claims to be a nation that promotes democracy and peaceful international relations, it cannot violate the UN Charter and violate international treaties and carry out extrajudicial assassinations. The slaying of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes was not just an act of terrorism, it's a stark reminder of American arrogance and hypocrisy, the real outcome of which we've yet to see. The United States can make up as many false intelligence reports as it likes and lie to its own citizens and the world, but General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi challenged U.S. hegemony, and that is ultimately the real reason that they were martyred. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
After raking in enormous profits from its coronavirus vaccine in 2021, the US-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has kicked off the new year by hiking the prices of more than 120 of its drugs, resulting in significantly higher costs for patients amid a deadly pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Year of Vaccine Profiteering, Pfizer Hikes Prices on 125 Drugs. Stay tuned for more. After raking in enormous profits from its coronavirus vaccine in 2021, the US-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has kicked off the new year by hiking the prices of more than 120 of its drugs, resulting in significantly higher costs for patients amid a deadly pandemic. That's according to a new report released recently by Patients for Affordable Drugs, P4AD. Which found that pharmaceutical companies have raised the prices of 554 medicines this month alone. Pfizer led the way with 125 price hikes to start 2022, leading P4AD to label the company the industry's poster child for greed. Due to sales of its COVID-19 vaccine, which is said to be the best-selling drug of all time, Pfizer shattered profits records in 2021. Projected sales for 2022 are $54.5 billion, more than double the previous record for one-year sales for a prescription drug, the report notes. To put this into perspective, AbbVie's Humira previously held the spot with $19.8 billion in sales, and Pfizer's best-selling product just prior to the pandemic achieved worldwide revenues of $5.8 billion. Despite this record revenue in 2021, the report continues, Pfizer began 2022 with price hikes on 7 of its 10 best-selling drugs, including its pneumonia vaccine, up 6.9%, a breast cancer medication up 6.9%, and a treatment for people with cardiovascular disease up 6%. P4AD notes these hikes of 5% or 6% can translate into thousands of dollars in higher costs for patients. Ashley Suter, a West Virginia resident who takes Pfizer's Eliquis to manage her autoimmune disease, told P4AID that she has had to spend her entire paycheck on medication and will likely be taking Eliquis for the rest of her life. Suter said, "With the price increasing again, I worry about how I will make ends meet while still affording my drugs." While the worst offenders, Pfizer and its subsidiaries, were hardly alone in raising drug costs for patients during the first month of 2022, according to P4AD, which also spotlighted price hikes by Gilead, Eli Lilly, and other prominent pharmaceutical companies. So far in 2022, the group noted in a press release, drug companies have increased prices on 554 drugs, 183 drugs were hiked by $100 or more, and 118 drugs with increases carry a price over $5,000. The average price hike was 6.3%, and one in four price hikes exceeded the most recently available inflation rate at the time of analysis. David Mitchell, P4AD's founder and a blood cancer patient whose medications have a list price of more than $900,000 annually, said in a statement recently that even as we enter the third year of a pandemic, Big Pharma continues its practice of targeting American patients and consumers with price increases, completely undeterred by the financial and health challenges facing American families. Mitchell added, drug corporations can do this because we let them, unlike other nations that use their purchasing power to get a better deal. The Build Back Better Act, Democrats' $1.75 trillion reconciliation package, includes provisions that would let Medicare negotiate the prices of a limited subset of prescription drugs directly with pharmaceutical corporations, something it is currently barred from doing by law, a prohibition that has contributed to sky-high medicine costs in the U.S. Democrats' legislation would also penalize drug companies that hike prices faster than the rate of inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high. But the House-passed bill remains stuck in the Senate as Senator Joe Manchin demands the removal of key Democratic priorities, including the expanded child tax credit and investments in affordable housing. Democrats are expected to continue working to advance the legislation in the coming days. Mitchell recently said the drug pricing legislation agreed to in the Build Back Better Act would curb rising drug prices for millions of patients and halt abusive annual price hikes by limiting increases to the rate of inflation, which is projected to return to 2.3% in 2023. The Senate must pass this legislation immediately, he said.
Welcome back to Aperture. We looked into the life of Muhammad Iqbal from his birthplace in Punjab province of British India, now in Pakistan, to his academic studies in the University of Cambridge. Iqbal was a very learned man who was known for his political ideologies and philosophical theories. He is fondly remembered as a great poet and scholar. The political content of Muhammad Iqbal's poetry is one of the most fascinating aspects of his work. Except for a few poems, his entire poetic endeavor is tinged with the political concerns of his time. Both domestic and international political events shaped his poetry. He not only responded to political events in his verse, but also inspired his fellow Indian Muslims through his poetry to find a way out of the political dilemma in which the British colonial rule had put them. Stay with us as we looked into how Iqbal helped his fellow Indian Muslims aspire to a better future and guided them on the road to freedom.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the royal falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes. Allama's poetry consists of certain periods. His poetry was at first as the poetry of the day. He would say at that time, my Urdu poems are like a building made of clay. Little by little, these Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with What Can Be Done, O Eastern People.
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture, is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains: Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thoughts domain.
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations. Because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Saadi.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings. Meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, there is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein.
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things and idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new world view into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, "To a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self."
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly faults of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native lands, people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall heighten ourselves to become a human being, all excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand, and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
इस घर की तामीर हमारी दादी की ख्वाहिश पे की गई थी पर वो इस घर में
This house was built under my grandmother's wish.
उनकी यहां पे बीमार
But only for 2 or 3 days she lived here.
चौथे दिन वो फात पा गई.
She was sick when they carried her in a car, but she survived only for 2 or 3 days. At the age of 11, my father lost his mother when my aunt was about 6 years old. My father and my aunt would come here every day to see Allama, who was lying on this bed. Allama called them and my aunt would come up to Allama and my father would sit on the other side of the bed. This way Allama would feel comfortable.
इस तरह वालिद लेट जाते थे
मैं उनके चली जाती थी शाम के वक्त शाम होनी तो स्कूल से आके
I usually went to see them after school
मैंने तो उनको इसी आदत
Allama was always lying on his bed and resting
मैं पास जाके लेट जाती थी तो वहीं पे सारे मेहमान
I was always beside him
हर वक्त लोगों
other people would also go there
मिलना मिलाना मुसलसली जारी रहता था
इस घर में कई लोग अलामा को मिलने आ चुके हैं कायदे आजम मोहम्मद अली जिन्ना
Many came here to see him among them General Muhammad Ali Jinnah Jawaharlal Nehru Muhammad Ali Jauhar and many other intimate friends of Allama
Allama sahab अपने बिस्तर पे बैठते थे और
They would come here just before or after midday to have a chat with Allama about topics like poetry philosophy or any other things
तो ये अलामा की जिंदगी
अलामा स्पेंट हिज लास्ट डेज ऑफ लाइफ हियर
वो इस घर में गुजरा
आई वाज वेल अवेयर दैट द मेन रीजन व्हाई इंडिया वेंट अंडर द योक ऑफ ब्रिटिश कॉलोनाइजेशन वाज लैक ऑफ नॉलेज ऑफ सेल्फ एंड रिलायंस ऑन अदर्स सेल्फ अवेयरनेस स्प्रिंग्स आउट सेल्फ डिपेंडेंस एंड इंटरनल रिचनेस Know yourself, know your hidden parts, nurture your parts, and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects, to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
در اقبال آنچه شما می‌بینید
Iqbal's philosophy is objective and tangible. He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people. Iqbal's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy. It can be put into practice.
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self, the nature mentioned by Quran. In this